I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views. As the coronavirus pandemic continues to grip the world in a stranglehold of anxiety and fear, discussion about the role Big Pharma will play in addressing this crisis, specifically in regards to an eventual vaccine in the future, has already begun, and with it, potential concerns about whether or not the pharmaceutical industry can be relied on to put people before profits. And that's not without precedent. After all, in recent years, Big Pharma has garnered much deserved scrutiny and criticism within the United States over its role in the American opioid epidemic. But, as our guest on this edition of Parallax Views will detail, the unsavory aspects of this multi-billion dollar cash cow industry reach even farther back in time. To, in fact, even the turn of the 20th century. Investigative journalist Gerald Posner joins us to unravel the often dark and shocking history of Big Pharma as outlined in his ambitious new history of the subject, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. Once referred to by the Chicago Tribune as a merciless pit bull of an investigator, Posner has previously tackled such subjects as the infamous Nazi doctor Joseph Mengele, the case for Lee Harvey Oswald as the lone assassin of President John F. Kennedy, the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, and an exhaustive history of Vatican finances. But his single volume, comprehensive history of the pharmaceutical industry in pharma, greed, lies, and the poisoning of America, may prove to be his most ambitious effort yet, and a timely one at that. In this wide-ranging conversation, Gerald and I cover a massive amount of ground, including details about the early history of the pharmaceutical industry, the development of antibiotics like penicillin, and the fascinating figure of Arthur M. Sackler, whose family would go on to found Purdue Pharma, the privately owned company who produced OxyContin, and thus became the epicenter of controversy in regards to the American opioid epidemic. I must say, I am not exaggerating when I tell you that this is a sprawling conversation that goes in many different and perhaps even unexpected directions. For example, even Rudy Giuliani, yes, that Rudy Giuliani, the mayor of New York, manages to come up in the course of our discussion. But you'll have to listen to find out why. And with that being said, let's dive into the conversation with Gerald Posner, author of Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. Welcome to Parallax Views, Gerald Posner, author of the, I would say, serendipitous new book, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. Boy, this came out just at the right time, I would say.
Yeah, I guess, you know, right time in terms of if you consider publishing into a pandemic when the penultimate chapter of your book is called The Coming Pandemic, and an infectious disease doctor ends that by saying it's not a question of if, it's a question of when, even though I never imagined that I'd be publishing into a real one. So it is a little surreal to see it taking place and unfolding as some of these people had predicted. This is the situation we're going to find ourselves in one day, and caught short because of the drug industry and its focus on profits. But here we are.
I'm just curious, your thoughts on coronavirus. You just had an opinion piece in the New York Times from March 2nd. Big Pharma may pose an obstacle to vaccine development. I believe you were also interviewed in The Intercept in a similar piece about Big Pharma and the possible profit motives that are going to come into play with the coronavirus vaccine.
Yeah, I mean, the amazing thing to me is that everyone's focused right now on, okay, let's get a treatment in terms of an antiviral drug, or let's work on a vaccine and make it in record time. And that's all good. But what they're losing sight of, and this is where pharma comes in to take advantage of the situation, they've done it in the past, is they're so anxious to get at the government level. They throw billions of dollars into public research. The pharma companies, one of them will come up with the vaccine or a vaccine that will work, and at some point that'll be deployed. And then that company and others who have the medicines to treat it will demand that they make a significant, at times, profit on it. And that to me is just outrageous. And then they will use all of the public research that they have gotten with public money and use it for other products in their pipeline. None of it comes back to the public for research for other drugs or anything else. And this is what we've done before on swine flu in the mid-70s. It's what happened with AIDS and HIV when the entire research for the first drug, AZT, to treat HIV was done by the NIH with taxpayer money and an academic research program out in the University of San Francisco. The only thing that Burroughs, the drug company, provided was the actual drug for the testing. And it was an NIH director who said maybe this antiviral that Burroughs has could be useful against HIV, went to the company. They weren't even manufacturing it because it was so toxic. They had put it on the sidelines. It wasn't even a product that they had out. When the NIH said, give us some of that drug so we can test it to see if it works on HIV, they couldn't actually manufacture it. They were missing part of it. The NIH provided the missing DNA strand. Then Burroughs gave them the drug. All the research and discovery and testing is done at the government level. And then when it goes back to Burroughs, they want a patent on it so they can sell it exclusively. Government fights that and loses in court. Burroughs prices the drug at $10,000 because of pushback from HIV activists at the time, like ACT UP. It goes down to $8,000. It makes them $4 billion in the first 3 years. So this is the history we're talking about. That's why maybe I'm cynical about this. If it could happen on an HIV drug at a time when people are dying of AIDS in this country, that a company could do that, don't think it's not going to happen again here on coronavirus.
So when the vaccine comes about, is there a possibility, I guess you're sort of alluding to this, that profits may come before we the people, or do you think there may be other forces stepping in?
Well, I mean, there's going to be a tremendous amount of pressure on the pharmaceutical companies not to gouge in this case because of the fact that the eyes of the entire world on it. This isn't just a case in which it's happening like with Ebola, mainly an African disease back in 2014. Here, every country is being affected. And we have since that time with Ebola, this Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, this CEPI out of Norway, that's supposed to make sure that pharmaceutical companies don't gouge. But it's clear that when the time comes, when they have a product to put out, they are going to be in a situation where they'll do what they always do. They'll give away some of it to the third world and fourth world. They'll make sure they look philanthropic. And then they'll make as much as they can to those countries that can pay for it. Look, it's a for-profit business. I get that. But there are certain times, especially in this once-in-a-few-generations pandemic that's taking place now, where you would think that they might have to share some of the burden that's being, you know, shared by the rest of sort of the business world, but they aren't. And I don't think, you know, necessarily it's patients be damned. We're going to put profits first. Both go hand in hand. That's what's unusual about the pharmaceutical industry. I learned it from the last 5 years of research. They can actually research a drug, look into something for a cure, treatment for an illness. And if they are effective at doing that, they make big money at the same time. So that's why these drugs for small genetic disorders that often treat populations of 200,000 or less, I talk about in the book, they're called orphan drugs, are the most expensive drugs in the world and make billions of dollars for the company because they deliver a drug that's effective and at the same time they price it at an exorbitant level.
Well, I think this can lead us into examining the meat of your book a little bit more. Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. But first, I'm curious, you have a pretty impressive resume with regards to your investigative journalism and the books that you have written. You've written about Mengele, you've written about 9/11 and Saudi Arabia's relationship to that, Why America Slept and Secrets of the Kingdom, two books that I think are very vital in looking at 9/11, and also God's Bankers. You've written on a number of different topics. How did you get into trying to expose or understand or reveal the history of Big Pharma? Oh,
by greatly underestimating the size of the task. I think that if I knew then what I know now in terms of the how what a backbreaking project it was, I might have not proposed the idea of doing in a single volume an investigative history of the American pharmaceutical industry, because in this instance, and I think you'll understand this completely. I was doing the last book, God's Bankers, let's say the Vatican and its finances. It's a 200-year history of the finances, and it discloses how they invested secretly with German and Italian insurance companies during World War II and made outsized profits on life insurance policies of that were cheated by the government of Jews sent to the death camps in Auschwitz. They life insurance policies of these Jews who were sent to the death camps. They took their cash value off the books, and it was worth a fortune to the German Italian insurance companies and to the Vatican Bank, which was secretly invested with these companies. So that was the disclosure. That was the big news out of that. That was a story in which I understood all of the things that I was going into in terms of finances, investigating, looking at the numbers, figuring out, following the money, the track of the money. Same thing with what you talked about before, 9/11. How did the FBI and CIA screw up? The Saudis, were they involved and were they part of a conspiracy that we didn't know about? All of those things are what I call typical investigative journalism, topics that are familiar to me. Going into pharma, I underestimated the extent to which I would have to essentially learn the technology, the details, and become a life sciences major. So that the first year of work here was really spent with me working so that I could understand and have a decent, intelligent interview with somebody about the drug industry, about the drugs that were out, about what had happened in the past, how they worked, the differences with viruses and bacteria. It was an entirely new field for me. I was a political science major at Berkeley back in the early 70s. I went to law school. I wasn't a science person. So that's what I didn't take into account, is that the field was so different that before I could do things that I'm used to, like follow the money, see what's different, where's the corruption, I had to learn about the field. And that was much tougher than I had thought.
On a sort of personal note about your investigative journalism, I thought it was interesting at the beginning of the book, you relate a story of how a colleague was sort of lamenting the state of investigative journalism. It seems like it's getting very hard to do investigative journalism, especially with the deadlines we're having now.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. It's a very tough thing. The public's also accustomed to it. They're used to something being up in an hour as opposed to waiting, a day for something to come in. There's a famous old line among those of us who are old-time journalists, and that was that after Hinckley had shot Reagan, everybody was in a rush to try to get something out. And I think at that time, the New Yorker still had William Shawn running it as the editor. And somebody ran into him and said, I'm working on this as fast as I can. And he said, what's the rush? Well, now no one would say that. There isn't an editor in America who would say, what's the rush? They all say, when are you going to have it done? And we are fortunate that there are things like ProPublica. There are things like The Intercept and others that will still send a reporter off for a month or something on a story that may be promising. And there's the possibility that they will return at the end of the month and not hit pay dirt. They won't come up with the goods. A source that looks promising refuses the end to talk. Documents that were promised to you at some point as a reporter never turn up, or you can't verify their accuracy. There are so many pitfalls to developing that story, but very few journalism outlets today want to take that risk. And as a result, I do think that a lot of good stories don't get done. I consider myself very lucky that I'm able to find a publisher that, in this case, Simon & Schuster, Avid Reader Press, allowed me to go off without knowing what the book was going to be, because I hadn't yet researched it. I hadn't done the research. They just knew it was going to be about the pharmaceutical industry and what I found. And that's rarer and rarer nowadays, because even publishers want to know what you're going to say and what's your expertise to say it and what's the marketplace. And I can't give them that. So I guess I'm sort of a dinosaur in the business.
And again, just to reiterate, how many years was this book in the making?
I started to research this in earnest in the fall of 2015. So I had God's Bankers was published in February of 2015, and talked and worked on that for a while through the Pope's visit to America that summer. And then pretty much started to focus on pharma full time that November of 2015. So just under 5 years.
I just wanted to note that because this is a really ambitious book, as you've said in other interviews. I mean, you basically wanted to do a history of big pharma in one volume, and that's a mammoth task. Maybe we could start with discussing the origins of the pharmaceutical industry, because it goes back to around the turn of the century, really.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's what is so interesting, is that we tend to think that this drug industry has existed in some ways for a long time. It really comes out of, I mean, you know, many ways. It's a German invention in the sense that it was chemical companies primarily in Germany that really started to market what would be the first rudimentary. They had the alkalines. They got out of it the first rudimentary pharmaceuticals in the mid-1800s. And there was no idea of, you know, what caused disease or anything else at a time when, you know, shearing started at that time. We think of shearing drugs. It was actually founded by a fellow called Ernst Friedrich Shearing. He started in Berlin. Bayer, Frederick Bayer, started a chemical factory at around this time. And in America, the Mexican year, I think it was a year after the Mexican-American War, two German-American cousins, they had they took a $1,000 mortgage out and they had like $2,500 in savings. And they launched Charles Pfizer and Company. It was a chemicals business in Brooklyn. Timing was pretty good because after the Civil War had started, there was this amazing increased demand in America for morphine, and that's where they started supplying. And that's what Squibb did, you know, Edward Squibb, Squibb and Sons. They were in Brooklyn, a small company, and those who followed them pretty much after that, whether it was Park Davis, two different people who formed it, or Eli Lilly, a chemist who missed the Civil War but knew the importance of it. They all came in around this time. And the drug business then was addictive products, morphine, until, of course, Bayer, the same team in Bayer that worked on developing and finding and discovering aspirin, one of the great all-time wonder drugs. 2 years later, found heroin, named after the German Hirosh, as heroic. They thought it might cure morphine addiction, and that was on the market in 1900 and sold here in America, as was cocaine and other products. So the origins of the pharmaceutical business, of the companies that we often know the name of today, were based on addictive products that they soft-pedaled, meaning they didn't emphasize at all what the potential dangers were to the extent they knew them. And that's what they lived on until they were finally all banned at the end of World War One.
I was going to say, there's even, I believe it was called Baby Friend. It was sort of a wonder drug that led to, like, infant fatalities.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine. I mean, all of these, so there's a period in which the beginning chapter of this book is really based upon what I call patent drugs, drugs that were sold without any restrictions. They didn't have to prove that they were effective. They didn't have to worry about their claims, a little bit like supplements are sold in stores today. But that's a separate item. But I mean, at this time, there were all types of there was a microbe killer was one. This German immigrant, Bill Rodham, had made it and it claimed to cure all diseases. And all it was sort of a pinkish type of liquid with a bit of diluted sulfuric acid and wine, and returned thousands of percents profit on every bottle that was sold. A woman in out of a kitchen in Lynn, Massachusetts, came out with it. She was a Quaker abolitionist. Lydia Pinkham came out with Pinkham's Cures, a remedy for women. And this Dr. Jacob Hostetter, and I use doctor loosely, sort of a doctor, had this thing called Hostetter's stomach bitters, which was basically whiskey to kill bacteria. But what you mentioned about babies, one of the most astonishing to me was this pitch for Cops Baby Friend. Their tagline was the king of baby soothers. And what that company would do is they would look through the newspapers every day and mark off the announcements of births. Then they would send free samples to those mothers. And what actually Cops Baby, the king of baby soothers was a formula was about a third pure opium. So over a period of a decade, it was responsible for more than 100 deaths of new infants, and it wasn't until nearly 1900 that they finally started to regulate it.
So it seems like in this early part of the pharma industry's history, it's almost hard to tell the difference between, you know, legit people within that industry and, you know, flimflam men or snake oil salesmen.
Yeah, absolutely right. And that's why that is what created the opening, in essence, for what I call the modern pharmaceutical industry as we know it in America, because those companies like Bayer, which had the trademark on heroin, and look at all of them at that point, were selling patent drugs. Their patent drug lines were large, but they wanted to differentiate themselves from what they viewed as the real sort of flimflam men going around to these state fairs and that, and selling goods that they thought were really just terrible. So as a result, they formed this, the American Pharmaceutical Association finally came around and came up with a list called the USP/NF. It stands for United States Pharmacopoeia and National Formulary. Now, all it meant at that time was it was sort of a basic list, meaning that you were using chemical testing and machine manufacturing, that you were producing a standardized and relatively uncontaminated formula for your medication. Doesn't mean your medication was much better than some of those that were being hawked by the most shameless of the medicine pitches in the late 1800s, but at least that gave you a feeling that it was a little bit better. And so those got the name as ethical pharmaceuticals, and the companies that went there promoted them for a whole series of things, many of which turned out not to be right. But it was the first semblance of what I call a difference between the outrageous flimflam men and a bit of what we call standard pharmaceuticals. And then after the Harrison Act in 1914 makes most narcotics illegal, heroin gets a little bit of an exemption because of Bayer's lobbying for a few years. But when the addictive drugs are finally out, meaning heroin, morphine, cocaine, marijuana is thrown in there as well. Cannabis was a big item in a lot of the early remedies. When those are all finally blocked, the real shameless purveyors of drugs, they are knocked out of business. And the only ones who can survive at that point are the emerging drug companies.
So early on, there's a lot of what could be looked at in hindsight as pharma, you know, almost being addictive drug pushers. But then World War II happens and antibiotics. Maybe you could briefly sort of summarize the story of mass penicillin production and what this means for the pharma industry.
Yeah, I think this is it's interesting, because what happens is you have this period after you finish with, you know, the addictive drugs are illegal, and pharma is an industry without a product. It's looking for something to do. They really did not understand microbes very well. So you remember at the end of World War One, there was the Spanish flu. Very apropos, considering we were now talking coronavirus. So in 1918, this amazing contagion takes place, and it really showed how bad the pharmaceutical industry was. They didn't really get or understand how single-cell microbes that could turn that pathogenic. They had nothing to treat it at all. They didn't understand at that point how bacteria, you know, change to replicate, or anything that was behind the plagues or the viruses were taking place in the world. The only real advantage that they hit, they made no headway on fighting infectious diseases. They did come up with a Los Angeles pharmacologist teamed up with Smith Kline, and he developed this cotton strip smoked in a slightly unstable liquid, and it was sold as a decongestant. That was essentially the beginning of amphetamine for medical use. And a Canadian group founded insulin, which Eli Lilly bought the right to, which would be revolutionary in terms of treating diabetes. But otherwise, the pharmaceutical industry was an industry looking for a product. That product turned out to be penicillin in World War II. The timing of it, it had been found by accident by an English, Scottish, actually, bacteriologist working away, and he didn't even realize how important what he had discovered in the lab was. But it wasn't being tested and brought to the forefront by a group of doctors at Oxford until the late 1930s and into the beginning of the war. The U.S. government realized the importance, and it knew it could save hundreds of thousands of lives in the battlefield if it could stop blood infections and the loss of blood and infections that were taking place across the board in military conflict. So it put a crash program, made it a high secret priority, was number two behind the atomic bomb, and literally That crash program provided money and resources and research for a dozen pharmaceutical companies that became part of it. By the end of World War II, they were producing more penicillin than you could turn out, but the government had built for them independent production labs and manufacturing labs and the fermentation plants and given them the equipment. When World War II ended, the pharmaceutical companies had found their product. It was penicillin and the other antibiotics that would in the 1950s become widely dispensed, the most profitable drugs on the planet at that time. And the companies that had a sort of a competitive advantage over everybody else on the planet were the American firms that had been given this giant injection of government cash funding and research. They emerged from World War II, dominating the pharmaceutical business, holding about 80% of all the world's profits, and they continued to dominate it for decades after. So that was the great turning point. Penicillin, a wonder drug, one of the great all-time discoveries, but at the same time, a wonder drug for the pharmaceutical industry because of this crash government program in World War II. It was what put them on steroids.
I think that's really important to note, that government involvement in this, because I think sometimes we gloss over the role that government programs play in a lot of major developments within our society, because we live in a society where it's sort of we want to believe that the sort of private sector does everything.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting because I really think that one of the things that most surprised me in doing this book, you know, there's a lot of things that surprised me. One of them was the extent to which not only was the industry essentially born on this government project during the war, and the government, you know, said all the profits you get to keep. But in addition, how many other times, and it happened on the contraceptive pill, it happened again on vaccines time and time again, it happened on influenzas, where the government would come in and be the one to sort of do the research and help the pharmaceutical companies move on to the next stage. The statistic that still boggles my mind is that from the 1930s to today, we have spent about $900 billion at the National Institute of Health on public research. Much of that has been taken by private companies, private drug companies, and turned into drugs that they then patent, make big money on, and none of it comes back to the NIH so they can do additional research. From 2010 to 2016, there were just over 200 drugs approved by the FDA. Every one of them, not just 90% or 95, every one of them had public research and public grants from NIH that had been involved. So the extent to which there's a public-private partnership is fantastic. It's great. It ends up with drugs. It would be wonderful from my perspective, I sort of talk about this in the book, if some of those profits came back to the government, not to just throw away into, you know, some fund, but went back to the NIH so they could do even more research.
And I was going to say the last note on antibiotics before we get into maybe the 1950s and the Sacklers and whatnot, is that when antibiotics prove to really take off, there's an issue with patenting that you bring up. Maybe you could briefly summarize that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because there's a moment at which the British researchers who are working on penicillin, one of them happens to think maybe it would be a good idea to go ahead and patent this because we don't know what will happen. And he brings it up with his other. He happens to be a European Jewish immigrant to England who was just this brilliant chemist, and he's working on the team. He brought it up with the other Brits that he was working with, and they had this meeting, and they sort of looked at him in aghast, and they say, you know, you must be kidding. It's like money grubbing. What are you thinking about? It's terrible to think about putting a patent on a drug like this. This is for the public good. We'd never do that. Well, once penicillin, no one had a patent on it, which is one of the reasons they were all then looking after the war for their own versions of antibiotics so they could put a patent on them and get them. But in addition, they learned very quickly in America that you could do so-called use patents. So if you came up with a method for manufacturing the drug that was streamlined or a little bit faster or developed with more potency at a quicker rate, you could get a patent on that. And then companies that use that had to pay a royalty to you. So what happened a couple of years after the war, the British companies, pharmaceutical companies like Wellcome on that were manufacturing penicillin, had to pay royalties to American patent holders on those processes. It drove the Brits absolutely crazy, as it should. And in America, one of the great innovations on patents was the attempt by a company to get a patent on streptomycin, one of the first big broad spectrum antibiotics that was considered revolutionary. It was just a microbe from the dirt that had been found in one of their labs and then worked on until they took advantage of its natural ability to fight microbes and pathogens. There was a question as to whether you could patent a product from nature. And the general feeling had always been you could not. You found it. You did due diligence to be able to dig it out of the earth. That's fantastic, but you can't go ahead and patent it. As a matter of fact, Jonas Salk, the inventor of the polio vaccine, was asked at one point if he would patent his polio vaccine. And he said, how could I? Can you patent the sun? He viewed this as being something that was for the public good. Well, not so with most American drug companies. They did try to patent it. They succeeded. And when they succeeded on getting a ruling that you could patent something from nature, it was a free-for-all. Then everybody was chasing that. And antibiotics showed the results. A lot of companies came up with their own. They were greatly overprescribed for everything from sniffles to headaches to whatever. And as a result, we started the early days of antibiotic resistance, which today is a big problem. And the other thing is it's the competitive marketplace. The prices dropped. They dropped to near nothing because of the fact that there was too much on the market. And so they, you know, by the end of the 1950s, the drug firms are looking for the next profit salvation beyond antibiotics because they need it.
Now, my understanding is that there were some people within the industry that felt that medicine should be developed first and foremost for people, people above profits, but that figures like, say, John McKean from Pfizer, he was the chairman of Pfizer, I believe you mentioned that company before, argued that no, it's not worth investing in drugs that aren't going to generate a substantial revenue.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's very interesting that because I do think that there was the old guard, as I call them, of pharma were guys like George Merck, sort of the grandson of the original founder of Merck. And he was not a proponent of the idea that drug firms like his should put profits first. So as far as Merck was concerned, he thought that you could put a lot of money into research. You could produce drugs sort of what I call the public good, public health, common good, and deliver the big financial results that investors and drug company owners wanted. And I think that was an unusual view because he was viewed as out of date by what I call the hard charging new group in the 1950s. And you said before, the key fellow who represents that is this guy, Jack McKean at Pfizer. He was of the belief that they could, meaning they, the drug companies, you had to think first about how much money was coming in. And as far as he was concerned, you could sell anything. His view was that if the marketing was good enough, even a mediocre drug could be sold. And Merck and others would have been horrified at that idea. Turns out McKean is right, because you can sell even a mediocre drug. And we see plenty of examples where that is. And remember, when I say sell, remember, there's no, as you know so well on this, but a lot of people forget, we're accustomed, we live in an era in which there's direct-to-consumer ads. You turn on your TV and you see ads for pharmaceutical companies, and there are ads in newspapers and everything else, or in magazines and on the web. Back then, the sales were, until 1997, from pharmaceutical companies to doctors. They had to convince the doctors to dispense it and prescribe it once a prescription was required. They had to say that the doctors had to rally behind that drug. And then if they wrote enough prescriptions, we just followed. So it's an unusual business in the sense that the people who the companies are selling to, physicians, for the most part, don't have any idea about what the drug costs. Especially today when we all have different insurance companies and different policies and different copays. They have no idea what we're paying for the drug. So they aren't necessarily prescribing to us the cheapest drug. They aren't providing to us always the most effective drug. They're providing sometimes what Jack McKean would have said is a mediocre but okay drug, because my sales team at Pfizer was able to convince you to do that. And that's not the most comforting notion.
So McKean launches Terra, and I may be mispronouncing it, Terramycin?
Exactly. Okay. Terramycin, exactly.
So he launches Terramycin, and he gets involved with this figure Arthur M. Sackler, who's an advertising man that one of the interesting things about him is that he's very interested in radical politics. But I think there's a lot more to Sackler than just the radical politics. In a way, your look at Sackler's early life almost makes me feel like some bit of empathy for him. He seems to have had some difficulties.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I know I had these conflicted feelings through the entire book about Arthur Sackler. We hear the name Sackler, and a lot, you know, many of your listeners will recognize it as the name of what Forbes magazine called the OxyContin clan. That was their description for them when they went on the Forbes wealthiest list of American families in 2015 at $14 billion. Arthur Sackler was dead by then for quite a while. He had died in 87. But if you take them pre-OxyContin for a moment, what I call the Sacklers before anybody ever heard the word OxyContin, they were, I was surprised at how far back they went in medicine and what roles, especially Arthur, played. And you're right about Arthur. He you know, grew up from a working class Jewish immigrant family in Brooklyn.
And in a time where, I was just going to add, in a time where being Jewish was very difficult, especially when you're trying to like make it in the world and, you know, WASPs aren't very accepting of you and that Jewish background.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And as a matter of fact, he knew it firsthand, although he grew up in a dominantly Jewish neighborhood. It didn't take him long to find that out because he and his two younger brothers all became doctors. They all were psychiatrists, as a matter of fact. But the younger two brothers weren't able to stay at NYU as Arthur had because the quotas for Jewish students had already filled. They had them for Black students at the time as well. So his two brothers had to go to Glasgow, Scotland, where they went to school and then came back to the States. And the for a long time, Arthur, when he got involved in the pharmaceutical business in terms of selling them as an advertising company, he used to play down his Jewishness, even would say that he was Catholic because it was a world where you'd have to sit around, as his lawyer told me, and I quoted him in the book on this, and I think you'll see it, and listen to these people tell quote-unquote kike jokes and pretend that they were funny and you'd have to laugh at them. So Sackler comes up, not, you know, being a bit of a radical, as you said. He led the helped lead the strike at his newspaper when he was still in school. His moral exemplar, and those are his words, was a Canadian physician that had gone off and fought at the front lines with Mao Zedong during the revolution and was killed. He gave money to left-wing causes. His younger brother, Raymond, and his wife were card-carrying members of the Communist Party. Arthur was later investigated by the FBI at his advertising company, as were his brothers, for about a two-decade period by the FBI. And in the 50s, much to his credit, Sackler Arthur gave his firm, allowed his firm to be a safe haven for journalists who had been blacklisted by their own newspapers, even including the New York Times and LA Times at certain points, and dismissed because they had refused to disclose to the Red Scare and Joe McCarthy's horrendous witch hunt before the Senate, whether or not they had ever been members of the Communist Party. And Sackler would give them jobs as journalists or writing ad copy for the companies or that. So you're right. There's this wonderful marriage at which Sackler is out there saying in the 50s, I'm looking to revolutionize the way you drug companies market your drugs. And Jack McKean as Pfizer is looking for some hot young upstart to do just that. And they match up together. So Sackler gets to do the terramycin campaign, which doesn't seem very exciting, another antibiotic, but he does it in a way that the industry never has. He encourages Pfizer to have these detail men, as they're called then, and they were all men, so but now they're men and women, sales reps, drug reps that go out across the country, and that expands very quickly in terms of numbers. He's doing free samples to companies. He's pushing the idea that you could essentially go in and tell doctors this brand is better because the company's better. He just fits in with the personality at Pfizer, and he makes terramycin the most successful launch at that time in drug history. They spent about $10 million on it, which was a record, and it was a brilliant way. Other companies started to follow and copy it right afterwards.
And there's an interesting, there's a few other interesting things about Arthur Sackler. I don't think we have time to get into all of it, but I think he was very against segregation, or he was very anti-racist, it seemed like.
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is so one of the things that's so interesting is I'm so glad you mentioned that. There's people think, oh, it's a history of the drug industry. Yes, it is, but it's also a story of the Sacklers, what made the Sacklers before OxyContin. I have plenty on the opioid crisis in Purdue and some new revelation on that later. But in the meantime, is that story beforehand of how they develop, and there's so much in there that's new. I think for readers, it was new for me, and it's interesting. What you just mentioned is one of those that during World War II, Arthur Sackler got furious about the fact that the Red Cross had a policy to refuse all blood donations from blacks. Now, they later accepted them, but then they started segregating them. So they collected and dispensed white and black blood. Now, the Surgeon General of the Army realized there was no medical reason whatsoever to separate blood by race. And he actually told that to the Secretary of the War that it wasn't medically necessary, but it's sort of psychologically important in America, I think was his lines back at that time. And labor unions, you know, militant left-wing newsletters, sort of African-American newspapers, the American Communist Party, they were all demanding change. And there was Sackler doing his bit as well. And he was outspoken. He called it ridiculous. He helped some students in Harlem with a poster they were putting up. And that's the type of activism that I admire with him.
And also, as a side note, Sackler also is someone who plays into a story that comes up in your book. This may be the first time it has come up, concerning a major German pharmaceutical firm that was involved in Nazi money laundering. And you got declassified FBI documents on this, I believe, too.
Yeah, you know, this again, it's interesting news to me that it makes sense. And in World War One, when the war broke out, they had a they appointed in America this sort of overseer to be able to take over all the German companies and run them for a while. And the same thing happened in World War II, but it didn't happen until the middle of the war. What was happening before that is Sackler was working in his very first job after getting his medical license at Schering in their fledgling ad department. And Schering, owned by a German company, the FBI was suspicious that Hoffmann La Roche and Schering and Chiba Chemicals out of Switzerland at that time were conduits for Nazi money to these blacklisted countries. And they were really looking at Schering, where Sackler was, because it had pulled together the patents for several different German companies that could be important to soldiers in the war effort, like adrenaline, a hormone that's used in cases of shock and items like that. So the FBI thought that Schering was selling the drugs through these sort of Panamanian false shell companies and funneling the profits to the Swiss holding company. And Sackler was one of the people that provided information to them. He's listed in the files as very helpful in their own probe. It's so ironic in a sense that here he is in the mid-40s helping the FBI see whether there's any money that's going off to Nazis. And then starting in the 1950s, the FBI is opening files on him because they don't like his leftist politics.
Well, I guess this all leads up to the question of how does the Sackler family go from radicals like Arthur and Raymond to becoming, you know, exemplars almost of capitalism? And how do they, you know, become more comfortable within the system, so to speak?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. You can see almost the slide, the metamorphosis or change as it takes place, meaning that in the beginning, there's a level of activism to them. Even in their work at Creedmoor, they were at the largest mental institution in New York State, 7,000 beds. They had all worked there at different times. Two of the younger brothers got dismissed because of their left-wing credentials. So when the FBI was investigating them, they said that they were let go because they wouldn't sign a loyalty oath. But they were still then active politically. And then what happens is by the 1960s, Arthur Sackler's advertising firm gets a new client in Hoffmann La Roche and their product Librium, which is sort of a mild sedative tranquilizer. And they make that the number one drug in America. And then 3 years later, La Roche comes out with Valium, which was one of the famous sort of drugs of the 1960s, from Mother's Little Helper's song with the Rolling Stones to Valley of the Dolls to, you know, the way that parodies have been done off of it with Housewives and Valium. And Sackler makes that the first $100 million drug with an amazing ad campaign that targets women largely in these sexual stereotypes, and then makes it the first $1 billion drug. And the Sackler brothers by that time had bought their own small Lower East Side pharmaceutical company that sold some patent drugs, and they were interested in making money. They moved from that political activism to the money that came in, and they focused on ways to do it. And that's really where we start to see the change in the 60s and the 70s. And you lose sight at that point of their political activism. They're no longer doing that. Arthur, what's he doing when he has spare time? He's a workaholic. But when he has spare time, he's starting to collect antiquities, especially Chinese antiquities. And he ends up with, you know, one of the largest private collections in the world, and a place named after him at the Met in New York. His brothers are doing the same thing. And they've lost their sort of what I call political fire.
I want to get into, of course, the main thrust of why the Sacklers are so important. I believe you initially were just going to write maybe a chapter on the Sacklers called something like the OxyContin Tribe. They're, of course, very connected to OxyContin and, as a result, the opioid epidemic. How does the Sackler family figure into OxyContin and the opioid epidemic?
Yeah, so, you know, it's so fantastic because, you said, I guess when we started, there was a bit of serendipity that I ended up publishing a book on pharma and, with a chapter titled The Coming Pandemic at the Time of Coronavirus. It also is a bit of serendipity how the Sacklers end up with the blockbuster drug OxyContin, because a nurse turned physician in England in the 1960s, Cicely Saunders, is leading the hospice movement. She's trying to create the world's first hospice, which she does, and opens in 1966 at a place called St. Christopher's in London. And as a result, she's looking for drugs to provide better treatment for end-of-life terminal cancer pain, because she believes that if she can find a better drug, then people could go home to spend their final days instead of spending them in a hospital. What did a better drug mean? She was testing legal versions of heroin and others, would be the chemical equivalent, but it had to be dispensed every 4 to 5 hours, which meant around-the-clock nursing. She was looking for a long-acting morphine or opiate-based drug, and the Sacklers had just purchased in 1966 a company in England called Knapp Pharmaceuticals. Knapp ended up delivering on that drug. They are the ones who came up with a time-release coating on what was the equivalent of an opioid-based time-release coating that delivered morphine for 8 to 12 hours and was her wonder drug. And that was the chemical basis and this discovery in the patents that the Sacklers then used in their American company, Purdue, to develop OxyContin a couple of decades later. So it's remarkable to see it come out of that push for hospice back then. That's how far back they went. And all they had when they came out with OxyContin in 1996 is not a different way of treating pain. It wasn't as though they'd come up with a chemical inside that's just oxycodone is the inert ingredient, which is used on a lot of other drugs. But as opposed to Percocet or Percodin or competing drugs, it wasn't instant release. It took that time-release coating that had been applied on the drug for morphine called MS-Contin that they had come up with and said it's good for 12 hours. That's what the FDA approved it for. And that's why it was a revolutionary drug that dominated the market from the start. The idea that you only had to dispense it twice a day.
Wow. In regards to the Sacklers, what I found really interesting was some of the things they would do in the name of profits, specifically tax havens and also the millions they made through a vitamin-based product. And that whole story is very, there's a lot of things involved with that that are very shady, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because there are a couple of points, and it's what you say. You can see how they lost any idea of how they might possibly be tied to their old political. They became sort of the face of what could be done in terms of capitalism, if you were pursuing it with very few moral restrictions. And one of them is, for instance, they were selling OxyContin out of Europe from a company they had called Mundi Pharma, which meant World Pharmaceuticals. And they avoided tens of millions of dollars in taxation by having it on the books that they were manufacturing in England, and then it was being sold to their Bermuda subsidiary, who would then distribute it through the rest of the world. Bermuda subsidiary bought it at a high price and then distributed it everywhere. But it turns out that Bermuda corporations aren't taxed. That's just the way it is. So it's fantastic, except they were never sending anything to Bermuda. They were just, as a matter of fact, going ahead and pretending it was on paper. And believe it or not, it wasn't illegal at that time in England to do that. It was just found out about 2 years ago that law has now changed as a result of that. But they took advantage of it, saved tens of millions in personal taxes as well. So it's just the way that they game the system, as many others do as well. And I think that on the question of the vitamin, there's a situation in which they have a vitamin product that they call a cerebral tonic. It's where they make their first few million dollars. And they are able to have a study done with a friend of theirs at a mental institution in which it looks like it could be a treatment for schizophrenia, or so says the study. It's never been replicated anywhere else. There are all types of questions about whether it's correctly done. The publications that then promoted the results of that study were owned by the Sacklers secretly. Nobody knew that at that stage. And when that got a lot of play, they were able to sell that to a company that then went public based upon that single product. And that's where they pocketed their what I call first millions to really get seed money to start up. It's an outrageous story of cross conflicts of interest that today we would just be saying to the SEC, have some regulation. They did it at a time when the SEC did not have insider trading laws, just before they came out. So the Sacklers always are skirting up to the edge after a while of what is legal and ethical, and never really crossing the line in terms of that legal basis. Although maybe OxyContin was the area in which I think attorney generals are now looking at it, not just for civil purposes, but to find out whether some of the family directors over time may have crossed that legal line. No charges have been brought against them, but I know that some attorney generals are looking at that possibility.
And of course, I should note the Sacklers own Purdue Pharma, and that's how this whole thing ties into OxyContin and the opioid epidemic. I want to note real quickly before we start wrapping up, you have some disclosures about Rudy Giuliani and other efforts by Purdue itself to sort of block criticism or push away criticism or investigations.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because Purdue, just when they were starting to get pressure, they came out with OxyContin in 1996. There were reports of an increasing number of deaths. I got a packet of documents delivered to me in a plain manila envelope, postmarked New York. It turned out they were DEA and FDA documents that showed a remarkable standoff inside the government about what should be done with these reports of OxyContin. The DEA thought it was a dangerous drug. They had reviewed autopsies from around the country and thought it was a factor in quite a few drug overdoses. The FDA was not persuaded and resisted, and it led to a tug of war. Purdue didn't want to take a chance, so the Sacklers hired Rudy Giuliani, you know, quote unquote America's mayor, right when he left office after 9/11. That was his first big client. When he opened Giuliani Partners, and he used all of his influence to sort of make the government try to back off. He knew Asa Hutchinson, who was then the DEA director for 20 years. He kept pushing at the FDA for them not to pursue the Sacklers. He got them to agree to plead guilty eventually, the company and three top executives, to misbranding and mislabeling the drug in 2007 to felonies, but they did no jail time. And they went out and continued to market it the same way. So in the early days, Giuliani was a savior for them in coming in and doing the work. Nothing that was wrong with it, but meaning nothing illegal about it, but certainly the type of work that today, I'm not quite sure how he looks back on it and feels about it. Maybe he has no problem at all. But at that time, it was an important element in keeping them going on their drug sales.
I was also going to note, you sort of draw a connection between the NRA's line about guns don't kill people, people kill people, and how it sort of becomes a model for Purdue Pharma to deflect media attention away from their company and the painkillers.
Yeah, you know, it was very interesting because in 2001, 2002, when the New York Times first starts reporting about Purdue and what's going around, it's Richard Sackler, who's the son of one of the three patriarchs of the family. And his idea is, he tells this in a memo to the rest of the company, we have to deflect attention away from the company owners by hammering on the abusers. The abusers are the problem here. It's not the drug, it's the abusers. And that's really something that does come from the old NRA. It's what his father told him, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people. And it's that same idea. It's not OxyContin and opioids that kill people, it's abusers who are killing themselves. And that was used by Purdue in the defense of some of the early lawsuits. They were always attacking the users, never taking any responsibility for the overprescription, the over and the aggressive marketing or any of the things that now we know what they were doing in spades.
It's interesting too. There was a lawyer, I believe Paul Hanley, and you allude to him in the book, with a chapter entitled Essentially a Crime Family. Hanley actually said this is essentially a crime family, drug dealers in nice suits and dresses. At first, that almost seems like a very hyperbolic, but I don't know. I mean, this is, you know, very deep and scary stuff in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting because I remember when I read that, I think it was somewhere in the latter part of 2018. He was quoted saying, essentially, you know, a crime family. I thought to myself, boy, that does sound like it's a bit too much. But since at that time, I then spent nearly the entire year in 2019 going through the documents and the litigation that had been filed, seeing the internal files. You know, I referenced them, talking and finding some people who had worked at Purdue who were willing to talk to me. And I will tell you that after getting through all of that, it's hard to say that it certainly was run as though it was, as one other attorney said, like a godfather holding his sway over a mafia family, meaning that the directions came from the top and they were carried out, and they were often carried out not for the best interest of patients. And one of the reasons it happened, and you mentioned this before, and it's key for your listeners to remember, one of the reasons that Purdue is in the hot seat is because it was able to adapt so quickly to the marketplace. It was so aggressive in its marketing. They're all aggressive. All the drug companies are. But it's a private company. So the others who were competing with it, Johnson & Johnson, they had an opioid out. They had Janssen Pharmaceuticals. Teva had an opioid out. McKesson was pushing through this distributorship. They're big multi-billion-dollar public companies. They have a bureaucracy built into them. It's harder to move fast when you have to make a decision. Purdue, much smaller, much tighter, family run. The directors give the directive and the sales force operates on a dime. And that's why they were able to keep beating the pants sort of off the competitors in terms of sales at the same time that it's now come home to be a problem for them because their blockbuster was OxyContin. And we know the end result. More Americans have died from prescription opioids in the last 20 years than died during the Civil War. That's a bad stat.
In closing, I always like to say on this show that I want to end on a positive note. That seems very hard to do in these times, especially with fears about coronavirus. But you do talk a little bit about heroes in this book, including a single mother. And I think maybe that's the, you know, positive note we can end on, this single mother and her fight.
You know, it's fantastic. I'm so glad we were able to mention that because I really do have a story. It's called, you know, You Messed with the Wrong Mother. And that's her quote. She says that to a Purdue executive at one point when they're trying to slander her dead daughter. Her daughter died of an OxyContin overdose. She'd gone to a doctor for back pain treatment. And the mother, who was a part-time nurse, Marianne Skolick, couldn't understand why. And she dedicated herself to become a one-woman army to find out with Purdue. And she chased them for all those years. She gave a victim impact statement in 2007 when they pleaded guilty to felony charges for misbranding the drug. And she went before the Senate saying, you know, I know you aren't going to stop. You're going to continue to sell this drug or a variation of it. You better look over your shoulder because I'm going to be there every moment. She pestered the FDA until they took some steps on this misleading advertisement. She was the one who was in touch with the DAs early on and helped them in every way possible. It's an inspirational story of what one person can do. And I came across her story with about a year and a half left on the research, and it was inspiring for me. And my wife, Tricia, also an author, works with me. It gave us a second wind because here we were in the deep details, as you said, of the project. And there was little light about, you know, to say, oh, that's a great story. I can feel good about that. Her story was that story, and it's told in that chapter. And I think she's the example. People say, oh, one person can't make a difference against these big companies, but you can indeed.
Just real quick, and then I promise to let you go. You've been very generous with your time. I'm curious, do you think there's any possibility for reform in the future when it comes to big pharma?
I do. As a matter of fact, in the book, as you know, having read it, the real possibility for reform for pharma passed, unfortunately, in 1962. Estes Gafalfer, the crusading Tennessee senator who made his name on exposing the mafia in the mid-50s in public hearings. Joe Valachi was the turncoat that told the stories that fascinated America. He investigated the drug industry, Kofoffer did, in the early 60s, and he wanted to control pricing. He thought pricing was out of control. So he had suggestions for limiting the duration of patents from 17 years down to maybe 5, forcing the drug companies to license their product after a couple of years at a maximum of an 8% royalty. He had all these innovative ideas that would have put a strict cap, but would have certainly controlled this exorbitant price spiral that we've seen in the last decades. But unfortunately, not only did pharma fight it, but the thalidomide scare came in 62 when this drug taken by women in Europe for morning sickness turned out to cause horrible birth defects. Then the focus in Congress turned from pricing to safety. And they forgot completely about pricing. They focused only on safety. And that's happened time and time again. Every time we sort of had some effort for reforms in terms of more transparency and a little bit of control on pricing, something terrible happens and we get focused on safety again. And so here we are with the coronavirus. We're trying to save the world in terms of a vaccine. No one's going to be thinking about pricing right off the bat. And sometimes when I talk about it and profits that the companies will make off of vaccines, people will say to me, oh, Posner, forget about it. Why are you even raising that right now? Let's just get the vaccine and worry about that later. That's how drug companies thrive and prosper, is worry about it later, because by the time you start to worry about it later, they're already pocketing the money. So I am hopeful we could have reforms, especially on pricing. We've been talking about it for, 50 years. I would hope that we aren't talking about it for another 50 years, that maybe at some point an administration and Congress could come in that could do it.
Well, all I have to say in closing is that folks really need to read Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. I'm not just saying that. This is a really vital book, in my opinion, and it shows that these things go way beyond, the headlines we were reading about pharma bro Martin Shkreli. You know, this is much bigger than that. In a way, Shkreli almost seems like a small fry in comparison. Yeah.
That's so true. He almost ends up in a few paragraphs, but almost as a sideshow. You're right, because that's how the public saw it. And I would have people, when I say I'm working on a book on the pharmaceutical industry, they would ask me about him. They say, oh, you're going to do his story. And it's hard to explain how he fits into just a small part of a chapter about orphan drugs. But he was just the outrageous sort of villainous character that was the front page for pharma. What is interesting is that although people know his face because of the fact that he was so outrageous, they don't know the names or faces of the pharmaceutical bosses. And what I mean by that is they live in anonymity. They, pull down their $30 million a year. They've got the big salaries. They've got the two homes. They're selling drugs at the high prices, but they hide behind the cloak of sort of these anonymous corporations. And it's very interesting to me. That's not just by chance. That is an effort. They put an effort into making sure that's the case. They don't like the Shkreli's of the world because they tend to draw too much attention to the business. They prefer just to go on their way and do it quietly. And for the most part, that's what they do.
Well, Gerald Posner, author of Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views.
I really want to thank you for not only having me on Parallax Views, but for one of the most interesting, wide-ranging, and innovative interviews I've had about it, because I understand coronavirus is serious. It's the topic of the moment, and so much of it tends to focus on that. And it was such a pleasure to be able to talk with you about an eclectic group of different themes that I think are, important in their own ways, and I haven't had much of a chance to talk about. So thanks very much.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with investigative journalist Gerald Posner, and consider picking up his timely new book, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. available now from Avid Reader Press and Simon and Schuster. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. I'm gonna forgo the hard sell of my Patreon. If you can support it, please do so. My big concern right now is that you, the listener, are safe and doing well in these trying times. The coronavirus has a lot of us worried, and I think about my listeners and how much they've done for me. So I just want you to know that this podcast, it's a labor of love, and it wouldn't exist without you. So please stay safe. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.